Standard issue for all women.
Hello, Mickey here. Welcome to this week's Sunday Chops. Now then, if there's ever been a time to escape into the glorious, powerful worlds of magic realism, it's now. And I offer a hand-on-heart, read it recommendation for Leonie Ross's incredible third novel, This One Sky Day. I'll leave it to Leonie to tell you what it's about, but it led to a wide roaming natter, and we talked about self-discovery, self-acceptance, the joy of source, the food we need, workaday magical powers, the power of pum-pums, vulvas, if you're wondering, transformative sex, politics with a big and a small P, and the evergreen glory of the word fuck. Before you dig in, present Mickey needs to haul past Mickey in to apologise. At the time of recording, I didn't notice Leonie's jewellery jangle, which you will hear throughout the chat. If I had, I'd have asked her to take it off. But you will get used to the noise, promise. Sorry though, past Mickey's a twat and she doesn't get a biscuit. Anyway, I loved Leonie and I loved her book. I hope you do too. Hello, I am joined on the Zoom by author Leonie Ross, a woman who wields magic realism like some sort of healing balm / the most incredible acid trip. Leonie, hello.
Hello, darling. How are you doing?
I'm all right, thank you. How are you doing?
I'm really good. It's nice to be here.
It's nice to have you. So I'm going to dive straight in. Tell us about your third novel, This One Sky Day, which for any US listeners is published under the name Poppy Show.
First of all, I'm so appreciative that you got the name Poppy Show right. Most people get it wrong, except Jamaicans. So, okay, This One Sky Day / Poppy Show is a big old tome. But I think it reads relatively fast, and it is about four people, and it happens across one day. And to my mind, what's happened here is these four people are having a very particular and special day. This is the day they kind of get a clue. They kind of gather all of the information they need to move forward in their lives. Mm-hmm. So we have one character who is a master chef. And he's walking across the nation, gathering ingredients for the most romantic meal in the world. He's been forced to cook this meal. We have another person walking across the archipelago. It's a set of islands called Anise, who thinks her husband's cheating on her and wants to find out. We have a third person, Romanza, who is a queer man and homeless. Well, deliberately so. He lives in the bush. He's part of a class of people called the indigent. And he is spreading graffiti all over the land. And we have Santine, who is getting married tomorrow and who is terrified. And so we have these four people with their kind of disparate but interconnecting stories. And to my mind, apart from anything else, it's all about different kinds of love. There's crap loads more, but we can start there.
Okay, so from my perspective as a reader, This One Sky Day is about many things. Love, and I include in that like romantic love, sibling love, finding love for yourself, but it's also about addiction, hunger, grief, guilt, and you handle them all beautifully. And you also handle them really oddly, and I mean that as a massive compliment.
Good, I love that. I think that's a great one.
But the theme that struck me most was that of otherness. From the indigent's treatment by the politicians and main islanders, to Romanza's queerness, and to the fact that every single inhabitant of Poppy Show is magically different to anyone else. Was that something that you set out to explore?
Yes. I mean, I think in a strange way, there are kind of two things going on here. First, there is the business of magic, which people pay a lot of attention to. Everybody in this country has a different magical power, and some of it is kind of really small, like you've got grey hair and someone else could do like time travel, right? And I've done that deliberately, that contrast, because the whole society is set up in this kind of complex way in which the baby is born and then you have to work out as quickly as you can what their magic is. Mm-hmm. Because the belief in the community is then that you work out the magic and then they're expected to kind of get jobs on the basis of their magic, and they're expected to kind of get their sense of identity from their magic. Now, that's kind of harder. I've got great hair, so why become a hairdresser? I mean, how do you interpret that? Or, you know, I can't fart. How do the people possibly work out that that's your magic, that you have no flatulence, right? It's deliberately created this kind of hierarchy that amuses me. So a lot of this book's kind of intentions, including about the othering, is amusing, and me wanting people to laugh at the the idiocy of our kind of social community.
Yeah, it's very playful.
Yeah, so it's playful, but it's also saying, if you take magic out of the equation now and just think about all of us being born and having different abilities and having different interests and how that gets involved in hierarchy, how that gets caught up in religion, how we begin to tell each other we should or should not behave a certain way. You know, you're a pretty person, you should be a model. You are an intelligent person, you should be an academic. You know, these ways that we put ourselves into boxes. So I'm kind of taking the piss out of that process. Mm-hmm. In terms of the othering, yes, there's a deliberate intention. I think there's a lot to unpack, but there's a deliberate intention there that there are our characters all to a certain extent are not quite part of the mainstream. So Xavier the chef seems part because he's famous and he's therefore quite lonely, which is true of a lot of famous people. Trying to get people to understand what it is to be looked at, to be examined, to be judged, people to make assumptions about you. Anise is othering or being othered because she has miscarriages. She is ironically a healer. That is her magical power, but she can't heal herself. As you said, Romanza is queer in a homophobic society, which, by the way, is not necessarily a reference to Caribbean homophobia, even, of course, you know, that is true.
I mean, homophobia is the gift that gives all over the world, isn't it?
Absolutely. So global. I mean, I will say this, Caribbean people might be quite loud about it, but I don't think we're any more vociferous than anyone else. And then Santine has actually suffered quite a lot of sexual assault. And so therefore that's making her frightened to be married. So there is, you're absolutely right, and I love your take on it. There is a kind of othering that is going on. I want people to talk about the secrets we keep, the shames that we have, the sadnesses that we have. You know, Xavier's also an addict as well. He's addicted to hallucinogenic moths.
I mean, yes, they sound great, but...
Yeah, they are great and they feel great and they will kill you dead.
With the otherness, the thing that I took from it that I thought was amazing was the fact that we can all other ourselves, that it's in us all to make ourselves feel like victims, that we're different. And actually the fact that we all are different and can do that glues us together as a society.
I think you're right. I think we all have a tendency, particularly in the West but all over the place, to think, here is me and my pain in my bubble. And we may intellectually understand that other people are in pain or have similar pains, but shame stops us from breaking through those bubbles and connecting with other people and saying hello, saying actually it's quite normal part of the human condition to soothe ourselves in different ways. I mean, one of the points that Xavier actually makes in the book is, yes, his addiction is kind of obvious. Everybody knows about it. They're watching him to see if he's going to take muff again. They're wondering whether, you know, he's officially gotten over it, but he's still tempted all the time. So his is a big and obvious one because he's a really well-known person. But he makes a point in the book, which is everybody has a thing that they're soothing themselves with. Like, he knows someone who can't be single. Like, she just freaks out if she's single and she has to find a partner.
Yeah.
He knows someone who, you know, is the sweetest, most wonderful parent. And yet if their child decides to argue with them, they are immediately disproportionately angry. And so they need obedience. And we tend to do this kind of weird thing if we say, here are the addicts over here. Here are the people with mental health problems over here. And here are the rest of us who are okay. And I don't think that's true. I think we're all soothing ourselves with something. We're all compulsive about something. We need something in common to make ourselves feel better, and we are in the habit of making, I seem to be going on about hierarchies, but comparisons between one kind of soothing experience and another kind of soothing experience. So, like, for example, if you go for a jog in the morning, every morning, and you need your jog, and if you don't get your jog, you're going to be a bitch to your parents that night, I think you have as much of a problem potentially as someone who is compulsively moving towards drugs. In fact, if that person is just having the occasional spliff, I think they might have less of a problem than you with your compulsive need to jog every morning. Yeah. Or you feel like it's a complex one, isn't it?
It is. I totally agree with you that we find those ways of self-comfort and self-soothing and then decide that ours are fine and then someone else's maybe aren't. And it actually just led me really neatly onto something I wanted to ask you. And you've mentioned Xavier, and he is a Maecenas. That means he is a master chef, as you said, but, you know, in a really lovely magic realism way, it means he can flavour food with his palms, and he's been sort of set the task of feeding every islander the meal that they need. And so there's a huge focus on food, which meant I was hungry the whole time I was reading it, so thanks for that. But I also loved that specific exploration of hunger, about learning to feed ourselves what we need rather than what we think we want. Is that a lesson you've had to learn yourself?
I've said this before in public, and I'm happy to say it again, especially connected with the issues of shame that we perhaps have touched on before. I have an entire lifetime of eating disorders. So my experience with food, and so including food in this book, has been complicated and painful, but also became part of my own kind of process of healing. Mm-hmm. My kind of sounds a bit wanky, but like being brave about it, because I knew I wanted this character, this protagonist, to be famous somehow. And for a while, he was a photographer, and I kind of thought, no, that's not quite right. And for a while, he was a painter. But maybe I'll make him a chef, because, you know, I'm a reasonable cook. Not great, but I'm reasonable. And I thought, I can go there. I can understand that. And I became quite interested in kind of the compulsions of chefs, and they're quite nutty, like, but they're really creative. Yeah. And they love food. They love food. And I don't love food. I'm frightened of food.
Yeah, same.
So I thought to myself, okay, but I was doing therapy and have been in therapy for quite a long time, and doing lots of reading and speaking to lots of people who are beginning to rethink the way that we experience eating disorders. As you guys said, disordered eating is probably a better way to phrase it. And I thought, why not include some of that learning? So kind of gentle experiences with mindful eating. You know, one of the things that Xavier talks about, he says his ancestors, or the Poppy Show ancestors, ate really slowly and mindfully. He doesn't use the word mindful because that's just such a buzzword in the 21st century. But he talks about, you know, taking it slow, and Anise, the female protagonist, kind of gets totally distracted by things going slowly down her throat, and she's like, I thought I liked aubergine, and now I realize I don't. So this was a kind of quite healing and positive and brave experience for me to write about food the way that Xavier saw it, which is this beautiful way to nourish a whole community. So it was the start of some kind of a different way of thinking about food for me, as kind of intricate and beautiful. I also had, of course, the writerly challenge of getting the right words. You know, how can I, on one level, it doesn't really matter whether it's food or anything else. If you're repeating an idea, you need to come up with different ideas to make it interesting. So you're thinking about textures and details and sounds and color and motion. So I began to get quite creative about that. And that was really good for me. It was good for me to think about food as something I was trying to make beautiful rather than something that hurt me or I had to count calories for or go on diets about.
And also, come on now, Leone, you have made it saucy as fuck. It is very sexy food.
But you see, this is a weird thing about me. I kind of, up to very recently, someone wanted me to write, because some people know me as writing about sex, and, you know, little sex goes a long way. So, like, you write one sex scene, and everybody goes on about bloody sex scene. And for ages, I was saying to people, there's only one sex scene in this novel. There's only one. I haven't written lots of sex this time. And then people were kind of talking about it as they began to read. I thought, no, there are five. And one of my good friends was laughing at me. She's like, how did you not notice that there are five sex scenes rather than one? What is wrong with you? I kind of really absentmindedly include sex and touch in writing. So I kind of don't notice that I've put it in. Whereas other people are like, oh my God, sex, right? So they kind of notice more than I do. So some of the reviews that have been lovely and generous and wonderful are like suffused with sensuality. I'm like, what the hell are you talking about? Oh yes, right, there were those sex scenes. Okay. And but still, I think I could have written much more about sex. I mean, you tell me, you're the reader. Like, I think your perspective on the sex is probably more relevant and wiser than my own.
It's a very sexy book.
Oh, good. Is there a scene that you like best?
It's not just the actual fucking. I guess it's the scene that springs to mind if you ask me to think about a sex scene in the book is Xavier and his former mentor, whose name escapes
Desiree.
Me.
Yes.
Desiree.
Yes, Desiree.
That's the one that springs to mind.
Of course.
Partly because it is super erotic, but also it's very key in Xavier realizing lots of stuff that he's going to go out and change and do differently. Yeah. Wow, what transformative sex. It's a real who doesn't want some of that? It also sounds like it's very good. But I think it's just the way you describe things is very visceral. The eating is very erotic, the savouring, the loving their course. So Santaine's wings are very sexual. Sorry, there's a little spoiler. Ooh. There. But just it's her as a very young woman, she's a very young character, discovering her body, realizing there's a change coming and doing something about it, and people not understanding her when she's telling them this is going to happen, and they're like, nah, it's not, and she can feel it. And that itself is very erotic. That ownership for a woman of her own body, I think, is still really refreshing.
Yeah, and of course, you and I know, of course, where she gets the weakness from.
Yes.
So I don't want to give that away. But yes, I suppose you're making your argument perfectly, darling. Yes, absolutely. Meant to be sensual and interesting. This won't really give too much away to the audience. This is a person with wings, right? She hasn't always had wings. She gets wings in the book. But I really quite liked the idea of, then she goes to see her boyfriend, her soon-to-be husband. And he thinks the wings are quite sexy too.
Yeah.
So he's like, and they're huge. They're not some little tiny foolishness. They're like, they're filling the whole garden. And he's kind of walking around her and touching them and tapping them. And she's laughing and he's trying to pick her up and see the different, whether he can pick her up with the wings. And then she kind of shifts herself. I have this real, I'm quite cinematic in my approach to writing. And I can see her like, and of course now our listeners can't see me do this with my shoulder, but she kind of just shrugs her shoulder slightly and it all just slides all the way back down into her and down her body. And I thought,
listeners
totally
can't
sexy.
See you, but saucy as fuck, listeners, saucy as fuck. On this note, can we talk pum-pum power? Because the women in this One Sky Day are strong and fierce. The OBR women of the Fatty Deek, they really rule the roost regardless of other politics. And it is the women of the, I can't say archipelago, so I've written island because it's a word I can't say, but the island's sexual energy. It's their sexual energy that turns Poppy Show upside down on this One Sky Day. So I am guessing it was a deliberate choice to make the women the powerful ones.
I think that's come instinctively. So I really like writing men, and I really like writing women's pains through men who are trying to do their best by them, which is how Xavier works, really, because he's been so hurt by women, but has done his best also to give voices, you know, to his mother, to his, you know, to his master teacher, to his wife, to, you know, the woman who he really loves, which is Anise. But yes, you're right. The women come through as, I think we have to be careful here, not just powerful, because I bet you are too. I'm getting a bit impatient with this kind of trope of the strong, powerful woman, particularly when it comes to black women, right? The strong, powerful woman who just goes through and she gets what she wants and she, you know, oh, fuck off. The reason I feel impatient with that is because then that is just one dimensional. And I think what it does is that becomes a cope strategy in and of itself. This idea of I'm strong, I'm powerful, I don't feel any pain. So for me, explicitly, lots of the women in here do have pain. And Anise's journey really is to say, ouch. She spent the whole of the last four pregnancies behaving like ain't nothing. You know, crying behind doors, not letting herself feel, because she's trying to be that strong and powerful woman. And she only becomes truly powerful when she actually faces herself, faces her body, as me and you know, and goes, right, where are my girlfriends? Where are my girlfriends? I need them. And actually reconnects with women and says, ow, ow, I am in pain. I am sorrowing. And I think that's strong. That's stronger than kind of pushing through and behaving as if everything's okay.
Allowing yourself to be vulnerable. There's incredible strength within that, but it's putting yourself forward and allowing yourself to be sad. We run away from sadness.
Yeah, but it comes back. We can't escape it. All of those toxic, you know, experiences, all of those feelings that we press down, and it's a very British way to be as well, but it's also a very Caribbean way to be. It's been enough now, you know. It's been 3 hours and 17 minutes, and that's enough time of mourning. It's like we don't work like that. And then we walk around the world pretending everything's okay. Can I tell you, Mickey, it's one of the things that irritates me most in the world. I've been like this since I was a little girl. I could see people pretending. It drove me crazy. I was like, just why don't you just cry? Just cry and scream and rage at the moon. And then healing has a possibility. But walking around, the walking wounded, all of us are walking wounded.
You need that release. Crying is a release. It's the literal physical release of stuff. And it doesn't mean that you have a cry and everything's better. It means that you have had a cry, you've released some of those emotions. And almost like, I know you said that you listened to Kelly and I chat about disordered eating and self-harm. It's almost being able to see it as real instead of it just being a weight that you carry. And also showing other people that you need help, that you're sad. That's why we have funerals, to say goodbye to people, but also the people around us know that we are vulnerable and need help at that point.
Yes, exactly. I think is another thing you guys touched on in that program, that there's no ultimate answer. There is no neatness. Even in this book, deliberately, at the end, everyone kind of seems sorted, right? But not because they haven't made some sacrifices. And also, I hope that I've left it, and again, this isn't really giving anything away, in a kind of vaguely vulnerable place. We hope that all of these people will do their best with what they now know. But there are no guarantees. Xavier still wants Moth.
Yeah.
Her niece is still sad that she can't have babies. And I haven't fixed those things.
Yeah, at the end, people are all right for now. But that's all we ever have, right? We're only ever all right for now.
Yeah, I didn't want to lend to that kind of narrative that says, and then they walk off in the sunset together and everything's perfect. I mean, I checked in with Xavier the other day because I always feel like I'm talking. I feel like I talk to them still. He said, you're doing well with all the, you know, the press junkets and everything. I said, yeah, it's really weird. He said, all right, well, have a good time.
Is he the one you talk to most? Yeah.
He's the one I talk to most. Yeah. He wouldn't talk to me for 2 years, like refused. I was like, what is wrong with you? And then I finally realized he's private.
He is very private.
I was demanding that he tell me his business, and that won't work with Xavier. It's like, get out of my business. So anyway, this may sound crazy, but this is the way I...
Well, let's go with this craziness because I'm loving it. And I want to say that it's interesting because these characters have been with you for a long time. This book was 15 years in the writing, so I am not surprised that they are still like, well, at least the main character is still having a little chat with you now and again when he bothers to reply. Why did it take 15 years?
A combination of things. I wasn't too sure. I'd published 2 books before. Good reviews, but certainly not huge critical acclaim. I didn't make vast quantities of money out of them. And I was young. I thought I would. I thought you wrote a book and then you were a novelist. And, you know, that's the way you made your living. And then you danced onto the next book. And it wasn't like that. It wasn't like that for probably lots of complex reasons. And so I had a long period of not wanting to write a novel anymore. I wrote short stories instead. I thought maybe I didn't want to be published anymore. Because publishing is different from art, and we know that, right?
Yeah, totally.
Publishing is full of wonderful agents and wonderful editors and humans who love the word. But it is also business, and it's about money and profit margins. And that frightened me and freaked me out, and I didn't know enough. I was very ignorant of the industry and the way that it worked. And then when I finally came back to it, I'd written the first 2 novels in a very kind of organized, pre-planned way. And I couldn't do that this time. So I did a lot of kind of instinctive writing, letting things just flow out of me. Huge mountains of words that I then had to kind of throw away lots of it, you know. When I started this journey of promoting this book, of finding out that I was with Faber, that I was actually going to publish another novel after such a long period of time, I was quite ashamed. Really embarrassed that it had taken so long. I feared this question of why did it take so long, because you hear in it, regardless of the curiosity, you hear in it a judgment, oh my God, you idiot, why did you take so long? But very fast, I've realized something. First of all, ain't nobody ashamed like me. Nobody is pointing fingers and saying, you fooled. But secondly, that there are lots of creatives out there of all types who are taking longer, who have longer works, and so are really relieved that it took me so long. You know, misery loves company, right? So everybody's like, oh, thank God, Jesus Christ, right? So there's that. But also a kind of really lovely idea that some art takes its time and it takes as long as it takes. And actually, as much as it was painful in many ways, and there were points at which I was beginning to lose faith, I think I'm right in saying that this book would not be what it is without the 15 years.
I think that's fair enough.
The next one will not be 15 years. Yes. I promise you. I promise. Like, I have an idea now, and like, I don't think it's going to take very long to write it.
It takes the time it takes, I suppose. Mm-hmm. And we do have to be kinder to ourselves on that score. We live in a world where everything is presumed to be instant. And I think pre-pandemic, that was normal. And if this pandemic has a silver lining, then I hope it slows us down a little bit.
agree entirely. I really think that it's almost as if our entire conversation in its way has been about us being very hard on ourselves, mm-hmm. as if there's some kind of what has happened in our human community to make particularly women so condemnatory, so expecting so much of ourselves, whether it is that we do things perfectly or we do things fast or we get answers really quickly or we, you know, solve things or we are perfect. It's too hard, man. Being alive is complicated. And I agree with you. It's in a way, it's a position of privilege. There are many people who are like, well, fuck you about slowing down. I didn't slow down. I had to go to work every day. And I'm really conscious of that. Yeah. I'm conscious as an academic. It was difficult, but I did sit on my sofa and teach, you know, and I could do that. But even having said that, I don't think it's wrong that this has been an opportunity for us to say, what the hell are we doing? You know, I mean, I could get into a long conversation with you about what the hell are we doing with our respective governments. There's also that. But for the moment, what the hell are we doing at an individual level? You know, how are we caring for ourselves and each other? And something about that means openness. And it's a very open book.
The joy of the best magic realism. So I'm talking Angela Carter, Toni Morrison, Salman Rushdie, Gabriel Garcia Marquez, your book, is it reminds and encourages us to look at the real world with that wonder that we lose when we become adults.
I love that about magic realism. There is a whole scene in which Anise is looking at our pom-pom, at our vulva. And all I do in that section is tell you all kinds of things about the way that the internal workings of the vulva works, you know, how the clitoris is, you know, how that connects to different parts of the labia. And I tell you all of this stuff that sounds magical. It's not. It's actually something that biologically happens. The idea that the clitoris is kind of underground, is subterranean, that it spreads across a much bigger kind of part of our body than we ever thought. I mean, think about this for a moment. We tickle the surface of a part of our skin and it produces moisture. Now, isn't that magical? We get wet, right? And we get wet to accommodate, you know, we're being heteronormative or putting things inside ourselves. And that's to accommodate that. And that's to accommodate desire and arousal and orgasm and all these things. I think that orgasm is a tremendously magical thing. And so magic realism reminds us of the gorgeous complexity and secrets and layers of normal life. And absolutely. I think that's really valuable. It's a really valuable practice for the world. It is something that even amongst all of my crap and my overcompensating myself, soothing all of those things, what I have retained at 51 is a deep sense of awe and playfulness. So there's lots of fear and crap in this book, but mostly there is that sense of, isn't it fun?
And it is. It's so fun. And again, I didn't send her my questions, listeners, but she is doing a really lovely order thing here. And so, yeah, you've touched on it before, that all of the inhabitants of Poppy Show are born with what you describe as a little something something, a little something extra. The local name was Cause Magic, but more than magic. And they are all different, from the ability to, well, the never farting to beautiful wings or time travel. And some of them are bonkers. It reads like you had a lot of fun coming up with those.
I think I did a lot of it based on the natural world, actually. We've all got our limits as our imaginations. I think, okay, I need another magic. Crap, what now? I'd Google weird things that animals do or weird things that plants do. So a lot of them, not all. At one point I wanted to make it so every single magical ability in this book kind of had a natural root and could be found somewhere in the natural world. It didn't quite work for the plot, so I abandoned that. But there's a lot of them that are a weird electric eel does this, or a strange kind of nudie brank figure does that, or a snail somewhere in the tropics does so and so. You know, people ask me often tremendously intellectual, serious questions about my motivation. And a lot of my answer is cause fun, amused me, because it occurred to me in the kind of natural motion of just writing on a piece of paper. And I thought, oh, let's go with that.
But I think that comes across to your readers, or certainly, like, I can only speak for myself. To this reader, I absolutely raced through it because I was having a lovely time. Hashtag. A lovely time. It was great. And I think all of the other stuff, the serious stuff, the political stuff that you deal with within this one Sky Day, we absorb it more. I'm a big fan of comedy, and I think comedy can tell us things. I think a sense of humour means that we absorb other stuff because we're having a lovely time. We don't necessarily notice it go in, and then later we go, oh yeah, it said that as well, and have a think about it. And I think you do that absolutely beautifully.
Yeah, I think humour is deeply political and deeply social, and that some of the biggest revolutionaries are comics who are simply going, look at this, look at this, you know, and just in bringing your attention to contrast or juxtaposition or the silliness of something or the hypocrisy of something pushes us to another kind of social place. I mean, there is a whole revolution in this book. The earth, and again, I promise you readers, doesn't really give anything away, because all these things kind of have an inevitability around them. We always knew that that someone was going to get up and protest the corruption and cronyism going on in this society. For me, it's a really simple thing. It's not complex. One of the things that they do have amongst all the magic is they have magic toys. And very slowly, over a period of about 10 years, the governor has been just swirling away the toys and selling them to the outside world. Poppy Show doesn't let anybody in. So there's suddenly this huge profit that's being made from magic. And the very earth protests at this. And so it is, in a simplistic way, my response to capitalism. It's like, don't go too far. The earth will protest, and good people will protest.
I think you're exactly right. And there's three really key things there that you've brought together. And that is protest, laughter, and food are all very social, and they bring together like-minded groups. And two out of three of them, I think, can heal differences. And protest can obviously make a huge change. We're seeing this as we record. We are seeing the difference that protest can make. It's incredible.
Yeah.
Which is why governments want to stamp on it.
Yes, exactly. And the wonderful thing is, I can't remember if it was Orwell who said this, but I'm sure someone will call you in or send you a message and tell you, but someone, it doesn't take a lot of people for that change. It's always just taken small groups of determined people. Mm-hmm. And maybe the rest of us kind of barreling behind them, you know, after a certain amount of time. So, you know, I also know that, you know, there are lots of young people and those of us who are perhaps a bit older who are getting pretty tired of the bullshit, right? Of the social bullshit, based in history, based in systemic, you know, problems, based in governments gone wrong and so on. Yeah, we're tired. But actually, I continue to believe, and I think this book expresses this, never stop yelling, never stop protesting, and that giving into cynicism is actually the worst of all. Intellectually lazy is loss of hope. Hope is not just happy, happy, joy, joy. Everything's going to be fine. No,
hope is hard.
Hope is hard because hope implies work, no?
Uh-huh.
Because if you and me believe that something can change,
We've
got to make a change. We can't just sit down there going, well, it will change and I will just sit here and eat a taco and it will change. No, it's like, well, how do we change it is always the next question. And it is hope that will keep you through the work.
When we're allowed to, I've been on a lot of marches and I have a one size fits all placard that just says, fuck this shit. And it basically works.
I've seen you.
across the board.
Exactly, because that actually, you know, I could have called the bloody novel fuck this shit. The joke aside, and that is true. What is the shit? How do we understand it? Who's in charge of it? Where's the money, which is often, you know, the answer to a lot of things. How do we disable it? How do we take care of ourselves while we're doing all of this? So how do we fuck the shit?
I wanted to talk to you a little bit about folk stories, because obviously magic realism borrows from stories that we've all heard, that they're modern day fairy tales. And whilst there is a Caribbean sensibility to Poppy Show at the archipelago, I can't say it, the island. I was like, why is it one of those? It is still an island all of its own creation. You yourself have got Jamaican and Scottish heritage, and that is a big old melting pot of incredible folk tales, which you must have heard when growing up, right?
But again, just really lazy here. My first two novels had lots of research. You know, like one was about rape and I was in the middle of rape trials. Another one, I went into the subway tunnels of New York City and across America doing research. The third one, I decided I don't want to do any research at all. So it sounds incredibly lazy, especially for 15 years. But if there are any references to real mythologies at all, this is surely from memory. Absolutely from childhood, little bits and pieces that have just gotten mixed up and included. The rest I made up. certainly there's an important point here, which is that Poppy Show has never been colonized. Mm-hmm. And so it is actually original kind of indigenous people, I would say mostly looking Native American, if I was pushed to ask what they looked like.
Okay.
And then in the 19th century, after the emancipation of slavery, a ship of quite a lot of ex-slaves, emancipated slaves, heads for Poppy Show. And they arrive, and here I'm trying to work in a kind of small irony, but important one, which is that they have been freed from slavery, black people freed from slavery, and they have arrived thinking they can now colonize because they have taken on the values of their former slavers. And the original indigenous people of Poppy Show go, well, you're having a laugh. We're not doing that, right? Yeah. And so there's this kind of standoff between the emancipated, which is what I call them, because there's never been a slave on Poppy Show, and the indigenous people, in which the indigenous people are going, well, we've got magic and we kind of like this place, and so you can't have it. And the ex-slaves are going, yes, we will have it. And long story short, the indigenous people convince them and they become part of the community and they take on magic instead, again, of enslavement. The reason I bring this up is because it made me think, and this perhaps was deliberate in terms of folk stories, how much of our folk stories as human communities are about overcoming problems, overcoming colonialism, dealing with people coming in and hurting other people, and how we cope with that and what came as a result of those kind of hybrid clashes and so on. And I thought, what would communities of color feel like if we'd never had that, or if it had threatened momentarily but then it went away? I think there would be much more space to be who we are. I can't imagine what the world would be like if Europe hadn't colonized it, but I've created this tiny space where that never happened. Then the mythologies, the relationships with religion, Christianity's kind of crept in a bit, as you can probably see, mm-hmm. but it's like a kind of side cult, right? Quite like making Christianity the kind of slightly eccentric weird thing over here that only a few people do. Uh-huh. But those who do are still hurt by it. They're limited by, you know, judgments about women and you know, horrible conservatism and so on. Anyway, I could go on about this forever. But I suppose to answer the question, the myths have come out of perhaps that root of my thinking. What is it like to have a community of colour that's never dealt with a history of colonisation?
And I mean, it's such a happy creation from such sad foundations, like horrible foundations, but you have created an archipelago of joy. I can't believe you've made me say that word.
Just lots of islands all jammed together.
That of joy. There's one more thing I wanted to ask you about, and that is to take you back in time a little to a glorious, glorious moment in your TED Talk from 2011 when you wax lyrical about your love of the word fuck, and you are definitely on the right podcast. And I just wanted to talk about that because we're 2021 now and women and swearing is still frowned upon quite a lot. I have been told off by an older man for my industrial language, and I am sure you can imagine what I told him to go do to himself. I just wanted to hear your take on it, and basically to hear you talk about how much you love the word fuck again.
I love you so much, I can't even begin to tell you. Actually, fuck is not my favourite word. My favourite word is fuckeries, which is a very Jamaican word. Yes, it's like something is fuckery, so it's both an adjective and a noun. I tell you my love of... Okay, so my... Oh, I can hear my mother in my right ear. Dear God. Right, okay. My mother keeps saying to me, don't swear in this, you know, press junket experience. And I keep swearing. Now, it is a habit. But also, in the back of my head, not very far in the back of my head, is this feeling. It's the perfect word. They are the perfect words to express a feeling, a moment, a time. I mean, obviously, we've got to the point where we overuse any word so that, you know, it's just, blah, 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 the same word over and over again. That's boring. But I do think, and I love Jamaican swear words. I mean, to stub your toe and say, pussy bomba rasklat.
Oh, that sounds, oh, I'm jealous, right? That you've got that.
Yeah. Pussy bomba rasklat is wondrous, right? So I think I like swear words because I think they're often right for the moment and to express the emotion.
There can be such a joy in it and such anguish in it. And I think you mentioned something similar in your TED Talk where you can be like, look at that amazing mountain. Fuck. Or you can stub your toe, and if you don't have any Jamaican swear words to hand, which I don't, you can be like, fuck. And yes, exactly. They mean such totally different things, but it was the perfect word at the time in both instances.
Exactly. Or you can be laughing your head off and going, fuck, 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 as your girlfriend are walking down the street, you're screaming with laughter.
Absolutely.
You know? It's a wonderful word. I think it sounds good as well. I actually think it sounds good. There are some words that are kind of ugly and harsh, but fuck feels neat and beautiful, and like I can feel like evergreen shoots coming out of it. There's something fresh about it. Oh. People now are listening to us thinking we're crazy. Yeah, to me, fuck is like fresh grass.
Oh, I like it. I like it. I don't know whether it sounds quite as fresh in my dulcet northern tones, fuck, but I'm happy to try to go there. Leonie, this one, Sky Day, is published by Faber and it is out now, and it is an utterly gorgeous, life-enhancing read. Please do read it, listeners. Where can people find out more about what you're up to?
They can find me on Instagram, leonie.ross. They can find me on Twitter, Leonie Ross. They can find me even on Facebook. I think it's still Leonie Ross.
Thank you so much for chatting to me.
Oh, thank you.
Issue for all women.